Chapter 10. The Gender Mirage. On the day you were born, or maybe even earlier, some adult looked at your genitals and declared, "It's a boy," or "It's a girl," or "It's an intersex child." Along with that declaration comes a cultural handbook, a package of rules and regulations about how to live in this body. What kinds of toys you should play with, what kinds of people you should love, what kinds of feelings you're allowed to express, and what kinds of feelings you will be punished for expressing, and lots of other obligations about what goes into being a boy or a girl. Among intersex babies, the families or medical providers often pick a handbook as their best guess. This is the gender binary we hear so much about, the two social roles that we assign to people based on their bodies. Like the sex imperatives, the gender binary is a collection of other people's opinions that we can ignore if we choose to. But the sheer tonnage of lies we've been taught about gender, our own and other people's, takes it to a whole different level from the sex imperatives. I think of it as a mirage, a shimmering optical illusion that looks so real. You can't imagine that it's just a byproduct of social dynamics, bouncing off diverse human bodies, creating the appearance of something that isn't really there. This mirage of rules you and your partner are supposed to follow based on the genders you were assigned are, I believe, the most pervasive and persistent barrier we face when we try to use all the tools from part one. At the most fundamental level, if we are struggling to create change, the problem isn't our partners. It isn't our changing and inconvenient bodies. It isn't even that we're stuck somewhere in our emotional floor plans. It's that we can't see our bodies, our relationships, and our world as they truly are, because we are seeing a mirage in its place, a gender mirage. The classic mirage is water in a desert. A traveler sees an oasis in the distance, a shimmering that signals relief from the torturous aridity. But the closer the traveler gets to the mirage, the more obvious it becomes that there is no oasis. It was an optical illusion. In our mundane, non-desert crossing lives, such a mirage might be the shimmer of a hot roadway, looking like a puddle, prompting us to drive around it. You know how you dispel a literal mirage? You shift your point of view. The closer you get to it, the more you see it for what it is. An illusion created by things that were actually there, but were not what your eyes told you they were. My goal in this chapter is to facilitate enough shift in your point of view that you notice the optical illusion that is the gender binary, with its rules and regulations that have defined our lives from the day of our birth, and that prevent us from seeing, understanding, and loving our bodies, our relationships, and our world as they truly are. I want to show you the illusion, describe what happens when you don't participate in the illusion, and explain how to do that. It might be my most difficult task in this book because the mirage had decades to influence your erotic garden, and you'll likely need as many decades to undo that influence. Better get started. Before I describe the mirage in all its pleasure adverse glory, let's make sure you've got access to the antidote: connected authenticity. What you need: connected authenticity. A classic structure for, say, a Pixar movie is that characters start out pursuing what they want, but in the end, they succeed at getting what they really need. What they want is the thing they believe will make them happy forever. What they need is what will actually make them happy forever. May, in Turning Red, wants to get rid of her panda, but in the end, she needs to choose to keep it. Miguel in Coco wants to be a musician, but what he needs is to connect with his ancestors. In Inside Out, Joy wants to keep Riley happy, but she needs to let sadness call for connection. Mom and Dad, the team, Joy realizes, they came to help because of sadness. What you want, what the gender mirage has assured you will bring you happiness, is to be an ideal giver if you're a girl, or winner if you're a boy. More on these soon. But what you need, what will actually bring you happiness, is to be welcomed in your community as your full, authentic self. Here's how the story goes. Imagine a little human born into the world and given the It's a Girl handbook. From the very first breath, this kid is in training to be a giver, someone who has a moral obligation to be pretty, happy, calm, generous, and unfailingly attentive to the needs of others. An infant's life literally depends on adult caregivers meeting their needs. The surest way to get that is to be good, to do the things they get praised for and avoid the things they are scolded for. So every day, our little human learns more and more about how to be a good girl. She's praised when she's pretty and happy, lavished with love when people witness her generosity and attention to the needs of others. What a good girl. Oh no, don't cry. Put a smile on that pretty face. That's right. What a sweet, pretty, nice little girl. As she grows, she begins to experience moments when she is not a perfect giver. She gets angry, and she is scolded for her anger. She wants something for herself, and she is called selfish. She is faster, or smarter, or funnier than a boy, and everyone looks away. She learns that some parts of her make her not a good girl. No girl is the ideal giver she is trained to be, and no girl was born to be that ideal. She is born to be her true self. Her true self is the gift she brings to the world, the gift she was given by God or fate or the random dice roll of the universe or whatever you believe in. But with time, her many experiences of failing to be a good girl gradually erode her spirit as a river carves out a canyon until there is an unbridgeable chasm between the ideal self she is supposed to be and her true self. But the handbook says that's not true. The handbook says a girl's gift is to be pretty, happy, calm, generous, and unfailingly attentive to the needs of others. And if she falls short, she will be punished. She deserves to be punished. Her skills in chemistry or languages or rugby are acceptable only insofar as they add to her being pretty, happy, calm, generous, and attentive to others' needs. Yet even the harsh self-criticism she inflicts on herself can't drown out her inner calling to be her true self, the self she was born to be. There will come a moment, not just once, but again and again in her life, when she will have a choice to be a good girl or to be true to herself, to behave like an ideal giver, or to be who she truly is. How do you want her story to end? Do you want her to learn to behave like a perfect giver, choosing to be a good girl and welcome in her community, as long as she never falls short? Or do you want her to choose herself and be welcome in a community of people who know and love her as she truly is? Which ending do you want for yourself? For your daughters, for your mother. In the best relationships, our loved ones encourage us to choose ourselves, even if it's less convenient for them. Yet many humans spend their whole adult lives trying to be that ideal self, neglecting and disparaging their true self as unworthy of safety, love, belonging. It's a rational choice, since we want to be good enough to belong within our community. As infants, our lives literally depended on others' love and approval. And givers are taught that our lives will always depend on it. Boys have their own version of this split between their true selves and their ideal selves. Part of the difference between the It's a Girl handbook and the It's a Boy handbook is the nature of the ideal you're told to match, not a giver, but a winner. Strong, stoic, ambitious, independent, and infallible. Ultimately, what it means to be a good boy includes being yourself in the face of others' objections. Indeed, boys are punished if they seem too dependent on other people's opinions and affection. The ideal of stoic individualism means that rather than being obliged to attend to the needs of others at the expense of their own needs, boys are obliged to isolate themselves, need nothing from anyone, feel nothing more tender than loyalty or camaraderie. A boy, too, like everyone, wants to be safe, held in love by his community, and to be who he was born to be. He needs authenticity in connection. And a trans person wants the same thing, but the split between who they are and who the world tells them they should be is all the greater. And the necessity of embracing themselves as they truly are, all the more urgent. They're given a handbook, just like everyone, and they do not see themselves in its pages. They hear themselves referred to by some pronoun over and over, every day, and may feel somewhere inside themselves, nope, that's not it. Maybe not yet sure why. The world demands that they perform something incongruent with a core aspect of their true selves. Yet the longing inside is the same as anyone else's, to be who they truly are, while safe within the human community. The whole LGBTQIA2+ community, along with people of color, people of size, and disabled, neurodivergent, or chronically ill people, don't need me to tell them that this is all more complex when other parts of yourself beyond your gender identity or expression depart from the ideal. We all want to be safe, held in love by our community, but we need to find it without sacrificing our true selves. This is the core of having it all. To be free from punishment for not matching the ideal. To be loved when we are our truest selves. We need connected authenticity. This is the antidote to the gender mirage I'm about to make explicit. Here are two conversational starting points for exploring how the It's a Girl and It's a Boy handbooks tell people to live in their bodies. As you listen, feel free to bookmark or take notes about the parts that feel true for your personal experience or that you feel you've noticed in your partner's experience. And just ignore the parts that don't feel relevant. An important note before we start. These are descriptions of mainstream Western culture's rules. Other people's opinions about how people are supposed to live in their bodies in general and how to behave sexually in particular. They may be uncomfortable for anyone to hear, even as I've tried to be playful and gentle in my approach. There will be silly music. I will use silly voices. But for trans, non-binary, agender, and other gender diverse folks, these upcoming sections may sound like descriptions of a violent perpetrator. I'm not trying to add that to your life. Feel free to skip ahead or buy a physical copy of the book, tear out these pages, and ritualistically set them on fire. Do what you need to do. The It's a Girl Handbook Five Rules for Living in Your Body by The Gender Mirage. Greetings and welcome to life. You've been assigned to the girl category of humanity. You're so pretty and sweet. Thanks for being so sweet. Let's talk about some rules for living in this body. The first rule for being a girl is that girls are the sweet, loving, attentive subordinates of boys. Weaker, nicer. We're even cleaner. We are also tough and fun and never complain that our feelings are hurt. Well, we do, but then eye roll, right? Girls. Being sweet, loving subordinates who are also tough and fun and uncomplaining is in no way contradictory. Second rule, we adore being adored. So we will work hard to please others. We are compliant, obedient, good girls who do what we're told. Being liked by boys is extremely important. Secretly, it's the most important thing. Even though we would never say that out loud. After all, we are also strong, independent women who don't need a man to be happy. This is in no way a contradiction. The third rule is about emotions. Girls have a variety of emotions, but mostly we should be happy and agreeable. We're responsible for making sure everyone feels good. And if someone doesn't feel good, we make space for them to have their feelings. Their feelings, anyone's feelings, everyone's feelings matter more than ours do. So we make sure we never inconvenience anyone with anything so troublesome as our own difficult feelings. Sometimes we do feel sad or lonely or worried or even scared, and then we need attention, which, again, eye roll. We never get angry, though. Well, sometimes anger happens, but we know that it's wrong, and we'll do everything we can not to let our anger make anyone uncomfortable. But sometimes it just builds up so much that it explodes out of us, and if people treat our anger with contempt, well, that's fair. That's being a girl. Fourth rule, we are the givers. We have a moral obligation to be pretty, happy, calm, generous, and attentive to the needs of others. Because this is a moral obligation, if we ever fail to be pretty, happy, calm, generous, or attentive to the needs of others, then we have not simply failed at a task. We have failed as people. We are failures. And for that, we deserve to be punished. If there's no one around to punish us, we'll go ahead and beat the crap out of ourselves. We search for ways to fix our bodies, to be nicer, to set better boundaries, to make our bodies smaller, to love our bodies more, to be more patient, to stand up for ourselves. We sacrifice our bodies, our time and attention, our hopes and dreams, even our lives on the altar of other people's comfort and convenience. Which brings me to the fifth rule, the sex rule. It's very simple. His pleasure is what matters. So be nice. It's selfish to be too insistent on experiencing pleasure yourself. Don't tell a partner what you want and like. Don't do anything to be perceived as sexual, but also don't do anything to be perceived as prudish. Be great in bed, which means do everything he likes. But never draw too much attention to your sexuality. If a woman initiates sex too often, she's a slut and a whore. If she doesn't initiate often enough, she's a prude, frigid, and full of sexual hang-ups. She should be easy to arouse, easy to make orgasm with vaginal penetration, easy to please. If we wear certain clothes, go home with a guy, get drunk, or have had sex with other people, well, we get what we had coming. If we're not pretty enough, we're not even worth raping. Wait, what? That can't be true. Isn't that just an appalling lie someone wants us to believe because they want to decide what we should do with our bodies and they think we shouldn't be allowed to... Oh, it's true. Oh, okay. It's true. It's definitely true. Our bodies aren't really ours to do with as we choose. Our bodies are in the public domain for others to comment on, prescribe treatments for, touch, judge, have sex with. And it's our job to smile and be pleasant and try harder to have a body that other people approve of and desire. If we aren't smiling and pleased to do whatever a man wants to do, we're a bitch. If we're a lesbian, we're a man-hating bitch. If we're a feminist, we're a man-hating bitch who can't get laid. If we talk about the patriarchy, we are blaming our problems on men instead of taking responsibility for our own shortcomings. Maybe if we asked more nicely, maybe if we wore different clothes, or more makeup, or less makeup, or higher heels, or lower heels, or if we waited our turn, or just worked harder, or were a little more patient and supportive of the men in our lives, we'd get what we want. It's not the rules that are the problem. It's us. We're the problem. Hi! And complaining isn't going to change that. The emotions we're allowed to feel about all this are happy and occasionally sad or scared, or even more rarely, lonely. Women don't get angry. And they certainly never inconvenience others with anything as ugly and uncomfortable as a difficult feeling. These are the rules for being a girl. Goodbye for now, and good luck. You're going to need it. The It's a Boy Handbook, 5 Rules for Living in Your Body by The Gender Mirage. Greetings, and welcome to life. You've been assigned the boy category of humanity, which is a real honor for you. But then, it's nothing more than you deserve. There are a few things you should know about being a boy that will help you succeed at eventually becoming a man, like me. Notice how manly I am? The first rule of being a boy is boys are better than girls. Being a boy is the opposite of being a girl, and being anything remotely girly diminishes your boyness. Second rule, boys are big and strong in every body part, including their brains. They know everything already and have contempt for those who are still learning. A boy can tolerate any degree of pain and has contempt for those who suffer without disguise. That brings us to the third rule, emotions. The emotions a boy has are anger, winning, and horny. You may notice some other feelings inside you. Those feelings need to stay inside. Sad is totally forbidden. Sad is for girls, which is the opposite of boys, so sadness diminishes your masculinity, as does its big sister, grief, and its mother, loneliness. Under specific circumstances, mostly life and death struggles, a boy may also be permitted to feel camaraderie with other men, #nohomo, but never anything in the panic grief space or the fear space. If you do express these emotions, you will be mocked, punished, or humiliated. That's how we help you stay on the straight and narrow. You're welcome. Fourth rule, you are a winner. Winners are obliged to be strong, stoic, ambitious, independent, and infallible. Winners have a moral obligation to fight and win. Fight and win forever. There is no win that means you can stop fighting. Fight forever. here's something that makes perfect sense. Boys don't need or want anything from other people. We're completely autonomous, but also we fight, win, and get laid, all of which require other people to participate. That makes sense. Fifth rule, let's talk about sex. It's extremely important. Your worth as a man can be measured in part by whether and how often you put your penis in someone else's body. Therefore, when someone, particularly a girl someone, declines to allow you to put your penis in their vagina, they're not just saying, no thanks, no penis for me right now. They're gatekeeping your worth as a man. If you're not getting laid, you're a failure. If you wait for someone's permission before you get laid, that's you needing something from someone else, which makes you a failure. If a woman says no to you, you are a loser, which means you fail at being a winner. Be confident, infallible, and entitled in bed. Never vulnerable, tender, or responsive. Remember, the first rule of being a boy is boys are better than girls. So if you're trying to have sex with a girl, the person gatekeeping your worthiness is less than you. You're letting a weak, inferior girl dominate and control you. The emotions you're allowed to have about that are angry and horny. Not lonely, not sad. Furthermore, the only way a boy is allowed to experience love and intimacy with a romantic partner is through sex. That's why sex is an absolutely urgent issue every day of your life. The science fact is that sex itself is not a biological drive. You will not die if you don't get it. Hunger is a drive. Thirst is a drive. Even sleep is a drive. And if you don't get that need met, you can eventually die. Sex is not one of those, but love is. And if your only way to access this basic biological need, as essential as food and sleep, is through sex, then when someone declines to allow you to put your penis inside them, it feels like they are starving you. The stakes are life and death high. You need the sex. You need it to be a real man. To feed your soul, you need it, or else you won't exist. And the gatekeepers of sex, mostly women, are weak and meek and controllable. So you can take it. Love is the one biological need for which we depend utterly on others. Though, never forget, boys don't need anyone for anything. And mostly, we depend on women. Fortunately, when push comes to shove, girls have a moral obligation to give you what you want, to be nice to you, to smile and be sweet, to agree warmly. And if you can't get a woman to treat you that way, you are even less than a woman. Harsh, but you can take it. You can take any pain. Sex is easy and predictable. Your desire is constant. Your erections are instantaneous. Your penis is huge. Men are in control of sex and of their partner. Men make women lose control. The crazier she gets, the better you are. Her loss of control, her orgasm, are measures of your worth. So make sure you make her come. Do you feel intimidated or inadequate in the face of the sex rules? Do you ever long to abandon them in favor of connected sex that prioritizes shared pleasure without performance demand? Then you are a goddamn pussy. Harsh, but you can take it. You can take anything. That's it. If you have any questions, you don't have any questions. A boy already knows everything and has contempt for people who have to ask questions. Those are the rules of being a boy. So long, and remember, just because you'll never win doesn't mean you can ever stop fighting. All of this is assigned to us based on nothing more than the shape of our genitals. And none of it was inevitable. None of it is inherently true. None of it is really how we have to live our lives. I want you to know what's true for you, for your partner, for your relationship. And the only way to discover that is to see yourself, your partner, and your relationship through clear eyes, without the distortions of the mirage. No one is immune to the mirage. When a friend of mine came out as lesbian in her late 20s, she was surprised to find herself in a culture that was even more rigidly binary than any of her heterosexual relationships had been. She told me, "It was like you're either a butch or a femme, and ne'er the twain shall meet. So many people were like, 'I have sex with you, you don't have sex with me.' And it was okay if you were a butch in the streets and a femme in the sheets, but then that's your only role in the sheets. I had more freedom in my hetero relationships than with women in that subculture." The first time she hooked up with the partner who would become her wife and co-parent, my friend said, "Okay, every item of clothing of mine that comes off, one of yours comes off too, instead of the expectation that only the femme partner would be fully naked." There are plenty of people who enjoy rigid power roles in which, for example, one person is naked and the other person never is. But my friend was exploring her sexuality in a culture that said sex had to be one specific way, and the roles were gendered, not according to people's genitals, but according to people's social presentation of gender. She was battling patriarchal expectations of rigid gender roles, including femme passivity and submission. But my friend was confident in herself, and she felt there were zero stakes involved in what both of them assumed was just a one-time thing. "I had nothing to lose," she told me, "so I could be clear about who I am and what I want and what I don't want." And what she didn't want was to be locked out of any sexual engagement that gave her and her partner pleasure. Any combination of people of any gender identities can find themselves stuck in the habits of the mirage. Every one of us struggles, in different ways and to different extents, to eradicate it from our gardens, including people who didn't grow up to be straight, cisgender, monogamous, and/or vanilla. But when you and your partner tend your shared erotic garden together, one of your mutual tasks is pulling the weeds of the unwanted, uninvited, cultural and familial messages that pop up over and over. It's not even a binary. If you weren't raised in the white Western world, you might have been raised in a culture with a different number of gender roles. Traditional Samoan culture has 3, but also 4. These things are complicated and don't map neatly onto Western white binary concepts. Traditional Navajo culture has 4, or 5. Again, these things don't really translate. Traditional Bugis culture in Indonesia has 5 gender categories, including gender-transcendent androgynous shamans. Pre-colonial Yoruba culture had people with different reproductive roles, of course, but no distinctions of gender. None of these cultures has a right or wrong number of gender categories. There is no ideal or correct number. But they don't have 2. When I hear people insisting that humans have 2 genders and only 2 genders because biology, they may say, I hear them saying that Samoan people, Navajo people, and Bugis people, among so many others, are less correctly human than they are. I feel confident you don't think that, right? Right. So now we have 2 different ways of recognizing that gender is not binary. We know intersex people exist, so we know anatomically sex isn't binary. And in many cultures, social gender isn't binary. We begin to see the mirage for the illusion it is. But without that information, binary gender, it's a girl and it's a boy, is so convincing. Just like the mirage of water shimmering on the surface of a road, We are seeing something real when we see the gender binary. We're just not seeing what's actually there. What's actually there is intersex people and communities around the globe and throughout history where people with what we would call transgender identities are a part of daily life. It's not just two, no matter how convincing the mirage. I don't mean that your own gender identity, the real lived experience you have in your body, heart, and mind, is a mirage. I mean that when we assign binary gender roles to babies based on the shape of their genitals, we're assigning them to a mirage, an illusion, not something that exists as a literal, real, universal characteristic of humans. People who are certain the mirage is real often have invested so much time, energy, emotion, and even money in conforming with standard ideas about their assigned gender that they resent the idea that none of that was truly necessary, that they could have chosen to participate in gender in a different, more authentic feeling way. We think it's real. We can see it. It looks so real. But the closer we get to it, the more obvious it becomes that it isn't really there. There are no rules we have to follow. We can be women in whatever way feels right to us. We can be men in whatever way feels right to us. We can be agender in whatever way feels right to us. We can be trans, non-binary, gender fluid. We can wear lipstick and a three-piece suit. We can wear a silk teddy and a beard. We can love and be loved. We can fuck and be fucked. All of us. The gender mirage is just somebody else's opinion about how to live in your body. You never asked for their opinion, and you have no obligation to agree. But how, Emily? I'm always looking for practices, exercises, behaviors people can implement to put new knowledge to work in their sex lives, to offer tips about how to implement this different understanding of what sex in a long-term relationship looks like and what obstacles we may face in staying connected with someone over many years. But when it comes to the gender mirage, a lot of the work happens all by itself while you're living your life. Like soaking a burnt pan overnight. Like planting a seed. You don't get a clean pan or a thriving seedling by doing a worksheet or even through daily practice. You simply allow time to pass in a supportive context. A soaking pan needs soap and water. A seedling needs just enough warmth and moisture. Liberation from the gender mirage needs trusting relationships around you and the ability to turn, oh God, not again, turn with calm, warm curiosity towards your difficult feelings. As I said at the start of the chapter, my goal is to shift your perspective enough for the mirage to flicker, so that you can see your body, your relationships, and the world as they truly are, in all their wildness. You will have feelings about it. The truth, as we know, will set you free, but first it will piss you off. Another way I say it is, sometimes the path to peace goes through rage. When people ask me how to use their awareness of the gender mirage to change their sexual connections, often they're really asking, what do I do with all this hurt? You know, or you're learning, how to move through the tunnel of all the emotions you may experience as you recognize what's true and what you truly need. Allow all of it. A lot of the how is, let time pass in a positive context. Good things come. You don't have to be in a hurry. You don't have to work hard. Let it sit. Let it soak into your mind and loosen the caked layers of lies and moral imperatives and shame. It doesn't happen all at once, which might make you want to get in there and do something with it. But just allow yourself gradually to see the world, your relationship, your partner, and yourself differently. Talk about what you see. Grieve for the ideal selves you and your partner will never be, and for the selves you might have been if you hadn't been lied to. Embrace with confidence and joy the selves you are, truly, as the shell of the mirage dissolves and you see each other fully, maybe for the first time. How do you get what you need in your relationship to mirage-proof it? How do you get to connected authenticity? Admiration, trust, curiosity. All the skills you've learned applied intentionally and explicitly to the ways the gender mirage intrudes on your relationship and your sexual connection. Though most everyone I've talked to has agreed that connected authenticity is at least a good idea, some people, maybe you, are so fearful of being alone that they absolutely would trade their true selves for certainty that a partner will never leave. They're frantically clinging to their habitual role because they've been told all their lives that that is how you earn the safety of the community's acceptance. If you or a partner are in that place, it has probably been pretty weird to listen to a sex advice type book that doesn't provide a standard against which to measure whether you're doing it right. The reality is, there is no ideal self to aim for. There's just you, as you are. You are already everything you need to be. And all the feelings you have about that, turn toward them with calm, warm curiosity. Oh, yay. Another opportunity to grow as a person. The good news is we can be both safe and loved for who we are, dark struggles included. But we can't have it alone. By definition, we need other people. At minimum, we need one special someone who know our true selves and love all of us. We get there by collaborating to mirage-proof our relationship so that we never again let someone else's rules control how we feel about ourselves and our partner. We stay in the wisdom that everyone wants to be who they are, and they also want to be welcomed in their community, satisfying others' needs. You can have that when you practice being more and more who you truly are and being loved in your relationship and knowing more and more of who your partner truly is and love them in your relationship. That's mirage-proofing. Margot and Henry. When I tell stories like Margot and Henry's, women often say, "Well, Henry's pretty exceptional, and Margot is really lucky. Most men would get defensive. Most men wouldn't just step up like that. Most men." So I'm going to close Margot and Henry's story by going back to the beginning. They confronted the gender mirage together early in their relationship. Henry didn't slide into adulthood already awake to masculine privilege and the gender mirage. He came of age in the 1970s, a difficult time to know what it meant to be a good man. He screwed up a lot in the early years of his sexual relationships, and he still makes mistakes. For example, early in their relationship, Margot requested an evening centered entirely around her own pleasure without her having to reciprocate. And Henry agreed. He loved her pleasure. The next night they spent together could be all about him. "Your pleasure is gift enough," Henry assured her. They had a delightful experience. Margot asked for and received A long, deep, full-body massage with scented oils, followed by a long, slow makeout session with zero expectation that she put on a show for him or give him anything in return. But then, when Margot was fully satisfied and ready to rest, Henry asked for a little more, just a little. He asked very nicely. He pouted playfully. Could he make her come just once? Margot felt like she had three options from which to choose. She could just go ahead and let him do more, even though it was not what they had agreed to, and it would ruin the specialness of the evening. Or she could have a good old-fashioned conniption, lashing out at him for trying to turn their evening together into something that didn't center her pleasure at all, just put hers first, and then expected her to meet his expectations, like her pleasure was a transaction. She could have pleasure on her terms, but then she would have to pay for it. A tempting option. But she chose her third option. She sighed at the ceiling in frustration and said, "You could. Of course you could. You have, often, and I've enjoyed it." But then tonight would change from the extraordinary evening we had planned, where I had a rare experience of pleasure free from obligation to do anything for a partner, into a very ordinary, typical, dare I say, normal experience, where I got to feel pleasure, that's great, but then I feel guilty about it and agree to do what you want to do because apparently there is no version of the world where I can experience all the unconditional pleasure I want, no more, no less. So I figure I'll let you decide what you want this night to be. Is it the night when I learn that unconditional pleasure is possible and that I might even deserve it? Or is it just another night when I feel like your expectations are my responsibility, even when you tell me ahead of time that they aren't? The evening lost the sparkle it had had, so Margot decided if she couldn't have the sparkle of unconditional pleasure, she would make her point clear to him, or else she would need to redefine their relationship. Henry said things like, "I just want to feel closer to you," and "renegotiation is always part of our connection," and "it's not like I did something you didn't want me to do, I just asked, and you were free to say no." Margot said things like, "Tell me why your desire for closeness matters more than my desire for unconditional pleasure," and "we negotiate ahead of time so that neither of us has to risk asking and being told no or being asked and having to say no." Eventually, she said, "I hate to put it this way, but whose side of this disagreement would your father be on?" "Ah, shit," Henry said. "To your credit, he wouldn't have cared about his partner's pleasure, right? But he would definitely feel entitled to whatever he wanted, regardless of what his partner wanted. The fact that you want my pleasure doesn't make it less entitled." Henry scrubbed his hands over his face. "Yeah, this isn't an approach to this conversation that would work for just anyone. But Margot knew Henry genuinely hated the idea of being the same kind of man his father was, entitled, aggrieved, controlling, and deliberately cruel. What would your father do was a reality check that brought Henry's gender mirage to the surface, like using a warm compress to bring a cyst to a head so that it could drain on its own. He never begged or pouted for anything after that, except in mutually agreed upon role play. And the next night they got to spend together, Margot did indeed invest the whole evening in his pleasure. In his younger years, Henry would probably have ejaculated multiple times during such an experience. Instead, he experienced multiple full-body, ejaculation-free orgasms that left his erection intact, though at half-mast, which was typical for his erections at that age, and his whole body shuddering. That's just a further benefit of rejecting the gender mirage, sex in the context of aging, free of the hang-ups around erection, ejaculation, dominance, making a partner orgasm, having total control but making a partner lose control, and all the other bogus performance standards that distract winners from their own pleasure and their connection with their partner. Seeing through the gender mirage is a lifelong project. But the rewards are so great, Henry keeps working on it. And it's not just that he has better sex, though it is definitely that he has better sex. It's that he can continue to explore and deepen his experience of eroticism with a spirit of adventure, play, surprises, and love. Mirage Proof now. Have better sex for decades. Regardless of your gender or your partner's, your sexual orientation or your partner's, or your generation, you grew up with weeds about boys and girls. And those weeds shape your erotic garden, both how you show up in bed and how you expect your partner to show up. But the rejection of the gender mirage is especially crucial as human bodies age. Genitals behave differently because the gender handbooks are inherently ageist and ableist. Aging people can no longer rely on our bodies to do what a body is supposed to do. If we cling to the belief that the behavior of our genitals is some kind of measure of our identity or our worth, then these predictable, ordinary age-related changes can lead to devastation of a person's self-worth or of the relationship, all because a penis doesn't get erect as reliably, or arousal is more gradual, or intercourse isn't as available. So sex therapists actively recommend rejecting rigid gender roles. For example, in their book, Couples Sexuality After 60, Intimate, Pleasurable, and Satisfying, authors Barry and Emily McCarthy, themselves in their 70s and married to each other for more than 50 years, emphasize the power of what they call female-male sexual equity, which releases partners from gendered mandates like the intercourse imperative in order to create space for variable, flexible sexual connections that center sensuality and playfulness. The greatest downside couples experience with this freedom from gender roles, they write, is, quote, regret and resentment that you did not adopt the equity model earlier, end quote. LGBTQIA2+ couples, too, can benefit in their senior years from their early rejection of rigid gender roles. In The Stonewall Generation, Jane Fleischman highlights two aspects of sexuality that I think we can all learn from. First, one of the most important factors associated with sexual satisfaction in LGBTQIA2+ boomers was low internalized homophobia. That is, the voice in your head that repeats all the worst things your culture tried to tell you about who you are. Homophobia is a central feature of the Western gender binary mirage, and these elders grew up more closeted than the generations that followed, with laws against loving who they love and medical diagnoses applied to their identities. How remarkable that they've shed those messages to embrace their sexuality as it is. No surprise it's linked to greater sexual satisfaction. And second, the LGBTQIA2+ older adults with higher sexual satisfaction felt good in their skins. They were not as polluted by body ideals as straight older adults, perhaps because they had never matched it. I never looked good in a dress, one butch lesbian elder told Jane. Aging couldn't take away her comfort in her body because she had already accepted so much of herself. In short, LGBTQIA2+ elders had better sex when they rejected the gender mirage. Straight elders, too. You can, too. Author and sex therapist Lucy Fielding uses this charming, gentle metaphor to explain how we can embrace the extraordinary diversity of human experience. Imagine you walk into an ice cream shop where there are dozens of flavors of ice cream in the case in front of you, but you look up at the menu and it just says chocolate or vanilla. So you choose your chocolate or your vanilla ice cream and walk out of the shop. And the sidewalk is crowded with people eating Rocky Road or mint chocolate chip or peanut butter swirl or strawberry shortcake ice cream. If you assumed you had to order off the menu rather than ordering based on all the many options you could see in the case, maybe part of you is angry at the people who didn't question whether or not they were allowed to order any flavor, who didn't wait for permission, didn't attempt to follow an unwritten rule. But what if we all assumed we could have exactly what appealed to us without having to limit our sense of the possible to somebody else's rules about how to choose? In my opinion, it's strange that so few sex advice books talk about mirage-proofing your relationship. Every qualified expert I've read or spoken to agrees that an essential step in experiencing sexual satisfaction throughout your whole lifetime is to work on breaking free of the "it's a girl" or "it's a boy" package of rules you were assigned the day you were born. Working to follow those rules and regulations has mostly obstructed your access to sexual pleasure, and liberating yourself from them will expand your access to pleasure. What if you were free to choose whatever was right for you, and you would still fully belong within your human community? I want us never to limit our sense of what's possible for our sexualities, never force ourselves to conform to somebody else's opinion about our sexualities and our bodies. Always to ask ourselves and our partners, what's true for you? What's true for me? What's true for us? Chapter 10, TLDR. 1. The easily proven reality is that gender is not binary. The mere existence of trans, non-binary, agender, and gender-fluid folks is all the evidence needed to prove this. But it can also help to dispel the mirage to recognize that many other cultures do not construct gender as a binary. Cultures can have anything from 0 to 5 or more genders, and they're all as real as a culture with 2 genders. 2. Messages about gender are ubiquitous and feel intensely urgent. But in reality, the more we allow ourselves to be who we truly are without reference to who we were taught we should be, the freer we are to build a sense of belonging that includes our authentic selves. 3. The "It's a Girl" handbook of rules for how to live in your body says you should be a giver who happily, smilingly sacrifices your time, attention, affection, sometimes your body, your health, or even your life on the altar of other people's comfort and convenience. The "It's a Boy" handbook of rules for how to live in your body says you should be a winner who fights and wins and fucks and needs nothing from anyone ever. 4. When we actively work to dispel the mirage, we can find what we truly need. That is, we can be safe and loved in a human community, even as our full, true selves, the selves we were born to be. Some good questions. What rules was I taught about which emotions are acceptable in me and which are unacceptable? What do I do when I feel an unacceptable emotion? What do I do when my partner expresses an emotion that I was taught is unacceptable in them? When do I work to ensure that my internal experience or needs do not inconvenience or disturb my partner? How does it feel to turn toward my partner's difficult feelings with calm, warm, curiosity. Who exactly does the world say I should be? Who exactly was I born to be? In what ways can my partner and I collaborate to create space for the true selves we were each born to be, dispelling the gender mirage to reveal ourselves as we are?